This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And it is glorious here. It is so wonderful. I love Florida. After a visit to Wisconsin, I decided I love Florida the best. I am so happy today. I have two wonderful authors, and I'm holding up the book for any of you who are watching on YouTube. Both of them have such gorgeous covers. The first one is Neil Mullock's Dark Blossom, and he is going to be on at the bottom of the hour, and I'm really excited to talk to him. And then the author I'm going to speak to in just a minute, her book is called The Buddha Sat Right Here, a lovely, lovely cover. And the author is Dina Mose. Dina, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, did I pronounce it right? It's Mose?
Yes, like toes with an M.
Okay, well, that's great. Now, I just want to play a little something for you, and then we'll talk about your wonderful book.
Thank you.
One, two, three, four. Wake up, wake up, wake up.
Okay. Okay, Dina, wake up.
You found my family band.
I did. I found your family band. I got such a kick out of that. I'm going to start singing that in the morning. Wake up, wake up. I usually sing Debbie Reynolds, you know, good morning, but I might try that every once in a while.
Fantastic, because nothing comes to a sleeper but a dream.
That's it. It's a cute song, and your family's so cute. And so I was really thrilled when I got this book, The Buddha Sat Right Here, A Family Odyssey Through India and Nepal. Because, one, I'm planning a trip to India. Two, I live half of my life mentally in my head in India because I'm writing a book about India. And so to get this book I was so excited about it, and it is fascinating, and it is so well done.
Thank you. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Well, I can tell you, you have to tell us about, you know, how it all started, but we'll explain just briefly that, you know, Buddhism is, of course, something that a lot of people they hear about it, they don't know too much about it, and you can explain how you got into it and you know, through meeting your husband. But one of the things, your first trip to India, it's so brave because you did it on your own, going to two of the holiest places. So I'm really excited to hear about that. But let's start a step back. How did you get into Buddhism, and which is really what propelled this whole trip?
Well, I had always been sort of a seeker at heart. I did grow up Reform Jewish, and there's actually an incredible lineage of American Jewish Buddhists. We call ourselves Jubus.
Oh, I know.
Great writers and thinkers such as Jack Kornfield, the beat poet Allen Ginsberg, Natalie Goldberg, even Leonard Cohen. And so although I grew up Jewish culturally, I was really a seeker in the early part of my life. And I say that yoga saved my body, and then Buddhism saved my mind. And I was out at a festival in the wilderness, sort of a peace gathering called the Rainbow Gathering, when I was 26. And I had just finished graduate school and become a nurse midwife. And I was longing for some spiritual guidance, and I always felt like a spiritual life had a depth and a meaning to all the sort of busyness and activities that we need to do as humans, and I've just been very driven to explore different lineages. But then I was out in the woods at this beautiful gathering, and I woke up one morning, and I got out of my tent, and there was a man sitting under a tree meditating with a big stack of books at his side. And I was so drawn to him, and the first thought I had was, whoa, whatever it is he's doing, I think I need to do that too. And I just sat down beside him, and that's my husband, Adam, 23 years.
Well, that's it's a beautiful story. And having been involved with a lot of tubus, I know what this need to find the answer, this need to search, is so strong, and that it brought you together and then brought you to this trip. Let's step another further back. You went to Yale, and
yep.
You became a midwife. Why did you become a midwife?
I was very drawn to midwifery because I wanted to serve women. I'm a very, staunch, lifelong feminist. I want to overthrow patriarchy. And I was, again, I was a young woman, and I was trying to find how could I do this. And when I learned about some of the difficulties that women encounter in very institutionalized medical practice around childbirth and healthcare altogether, I just felt very drawn. And as I learned about midwives and learned that they provide women a more holistic and woman-centered experience of healthcare, it was a calling. I knew that was what I was supposed to do with my life. And so I went back to school and got my training. So, and I have loved my career as a midwife. And it's just such a wonderful gift to be able to help people and make a living at it.
Once you got married and you had a family, when was your first trip to India, and why did you go?
Yes, I went in 2011. So my sister is Amy is an amazing. She's a foreign correspondent, and she had lived in India and Thailand for 15 years. But we never quite made it over there to visit her. We never could quite scramble the money together at the time. And then she surprised us all by having a baby at the age of 45. And this was someone who wasn't going to have children. So it was just this incredible thing that happened for her. And I just had to go and see her. And my kids were in third and sixth grade. And my husband said, yeah, go. So I went to India for a very brief trip, just a couple weeks, and I spent a lot of my time just with her and with the baby postpartum. And then I got to take a little bit of some journeying into India, and India just filled my blood. I just became so entranced by these holy places that I visited. And when I got back, all I could think about was coming back to India, and could we bring the whole family and just go for a long chunk of time and homeschool the kids and do this whole thing. So
set the stage for us, because most people, people think about going to India, people dream about going to India, but most people are not as adventurous as you were, that you actually set off on your own. And tell us from the two places the holy places that you wanted to visit, and how you got there, and just a little bit about that trip before we get to the big family trip.
Okay, sure. So I went to two very holy places in North India that were just about an overnight train distance from New Delhi, where my sister lives. So I went to Varanasi, which is a very holy city for the Hindu religion. The Ganges River flows through there, and the Ganges is considered a very sacred river. And Hindu pilgrims come to bathe in those waters, which legend has it washes away lifetimes of negativity and sins and bad karma. And so most of the Hindus in India try at least once to go to Varanasi to wash in the river Ganges. And it's said to be Shiva's, Lord Shiva's city. And then about 4 hours by train from there is a place called Bodh Gaya. And so Bodh means awakening and Gaya means place. So it is a place of awakening. Well, who awakened there? None other than Prince Siddhartha, who sat under a tree in a park there 2,500 years ago and then awakened to full enlightenment and became the Buddha. And that spot is there. You can go and you can sit in the exact spot where the Buddha sat. And it's really hard for Americans to understand the power of these kinds of sacred places that have unbroken lineages of devotion and prayer for thousands of years. It's extremely powerful, and it was a very beautiful experience. It was a rugged experience to get there. I had to wait in a train. My train was like 12 hours late, and so I ended up just kind of in the train station all night waiting for my train and didn't get to have any sleep at all. But when I got there, the power of being in such an incredible place, just, wow, it lifted me up. It just transformed me.
And, of course, when you're traveling in India, women travel in separate cars from the men, right?
No,
not all the time?
No, there's only one. I only saw that in one spot. In New Delhi, the New Delhi metro system does have a ladies-only car.
But the trains
are for everybody. And the truth is that there's so many people and so many families. I always felt very safe. And, you know, my sister, who had lived in India for 10 years, you know, she told me I would be safe. And she was right. There's a lot of misconception about dangers. You know, so if you travel in a place like India and you're a Western woman, the trick is just when you get there, buy the local clothes. So the Indian clothes are so beautiful and modest. They're called salwar kameezes, and they're these long, cotton, loose shirts with gorgeous colors and designs, but they cover your body, and I just draped a little scarf around me, and I could pull it over my hair if I wanted to be a little more incognito, and I always felt very safe. And so that's like, by respecting the culture and not wearing my, you know, California tank top and shorts, which would be very inappropriate there, by respecting the culture, then people are really so kind and respectful to me in return.
Well, that's nice to know, because they've been having all these shows on all of these streaming things, and they're showing these terrible cars and where they have to push people in and the women have to be separated. And so I think that's great, because I didn't know, and I'm planning to go to India, so it's nice to hear that.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of why I wrote this book is to just share that, you know, despite what the headlines say and what the mainstream, you know, media and television tries to project, the world is a wonderful place full of kind people. And, you know, it's good to be smart and to follow some basic safety, but to have, you know, cultivate this kind of fearful attitude about other countries and other places that maybe we just don't understand, that's just not going to help our planet to evolve. And we really need to cooperate as a global family. We need to start thinking more in terms of understanding and respecting each other than, you know, building more walls, as it were, and creating more fear. So that's a lot of why, you know, my book, The Spirit, is just, you know, full of love for India, and it's genuine. And India was extremely kind to my family, and you know, I just want to have a voice that counters all the fear.
So, how did you get your family there? How did you get them all on the same trip?
Well, my husband had spent a year in India in his 20s before we met, like a couple years before we met. That's where he got all his practices that I found him under the tree doing. And he always we always talked about going to India together. And then, of course, babies and businesses and a mortgage and all those things, you know, started our American life as a family. And it got kind of pushed to the back burner. You know, we always raised our kids with pretty adventurous travel. We camp a lot. We go out to pretty remote places and go on adventures. And our kids have really grown up with an adventurous spirit, just like their parents. So when I got back from India, my first visit to see my sister, you know, I realized that if I wait until my kids were grown and out of the house, I mean, we don't know what the future brings. There's no guarantees. I may never make it for my big dream India trip. So I started thinking about it differently, and I realized that my kids were sturdy, and they could carry their own backpacks, and, you know, if they missed some school, they were still young enough that, you know, it wouldn't throw them off for the rest of their lives, and surely it has not. And
I'm sure it's been such a wonderful thing for their lives that it really has opened their eyes to so much. And I homeschooled my kids, and I did the same thing. We took them everywhere because I wanted them to be in those places where history was made. And you know, missing a few months of school even my homeschool. It's educational to travel. It's wonderful.
Exactly. I mean, they learn so much about themselves and about the world. I mean, you can't even quantify it, what they learned in our 8 months of travel there.
And the beautiful thing is you included them. You included them in their writing in this book. I think one of the reasons I just love this book so much, as I, you know, I'm reading about India and discovering so many things, and I'm just loving, you know, your perspective on everything and all the things that you feel. But what I love is that you've included your daughters their own words and their own writing, and you haven't corrected it. It's just what they were thinking, and it's beautifully done.
Yeah, we got back and I started toying with the idea of writing more extensively about our trip, my 14-year-old daughter at the time, she handed me her diary that she had kept the entire trip. And she said, here you go, Mom. You know, feel free to use this if it helps you. And then I just started reading through it, and I was just blown away by her perceptions. I mean, this was her first trip outside of the United States, and she was a middle schooler. And, you know, just all of that adolescent angst and change and, you know, trying to balance where she is with wondering what her friends are up to back home in California. And just her observations were so fresh, and so I asked her if I could just excerpt some of them, and then, yeah, I just think they create a really nice balance to my narrative. And then Sophia's and her drawings. She was much younger, and
her drawings are so cute.
Yeah, so it was, and that makes it truly a family memoir, and everybody's voice is included, which I feel like it's unique in the genre of, you know, memoir.
It is.
Women writing about their trips and their, you know, the journey of self-discovery, but it includes the whole family.
Well, tell us, you know, I don't have a lot of time, and I realize that I'm going to have you back because there's so much in this book. there's so much in this book that I want to talk to you about, and I do want, I'm going to have a program in the summer about writing memoirs. From the perspective of, I'm going to have an agent who specializes in memoirs, and I think you would be the ideal guest to come on and tell us more about the process of it. But since we have so few minutes, tell us a few of the real highlights of the trip.
Okay. Well, I almost named the book Just in Time because we sort of planned our general travels around the seasons in India, and there's certain places that are at their ideal in certain times of the year. And I just loosely structured our itinerary that way. But we ended up landing in places that we as soon as we got there, we heard, you're just in time for this special event that only happens once a year. And I mean, one of the highlights was we were in Dharamsala, India, which is up in the Himalayas, And it's a big community of Tibetan refugees who have left Tibet, which is under Chinese occupation, and they crossed the Himalayas to live with religious freedom in India. And India has really welcomed any Tibetan refugees who make it to the border in a very beautiful way. And so there's several large communities of Tibetans in India, and the one that we were in was Dharamsala, which is actually where His Holiness the Dalai Lama resides and has his Tibetan government in exile, and a lot of monasteries and nunneries which have been destroyed in Tibet and have been now rebuilt in India. So we were there, and he gave a public audience in the courtyard of his home one Saturday morning, and so we got to meet the Dalai Lama.
Wow!
And
it's such a thrill. It makes me tingle to think about it.
Yeah, you know, he is truly a human being who is just unconditional love. Like, that is his essence. I mean, that's all of our essences, but we all have our stuff that sort of covers it over and distracts us from that. But his is just sort of realized, it is just right there. And I was literally knocked over by the power of experiencing that kind of love and compassion when I met him. It was very profound.
Wow.
And yeah, so that was definitely a highlight of the journey.
Well, it is. It's just really so exciting to think about that you go all the way, you know, the other side of the world, and you have this opportunity to actually be in his presence and to meet him.
Yeah, we never expected that. I mean, that was not why we went or anything. And so it was just circumstances. So that was amazing. And then another really amazing thing was we journeyed up to the to Ladakh, which is up in the high Himalayas, really next to Tibet, but it's on the Indian side of the border. And the Ladakhi people are very similar to Tibetan, as is Ladakhi language, and it's the Buddhist. It's a Buddhist kingdom. I like to say it used to be a kingdom, now it's a state, but it's the Buddhist kingdom. It's on the roof of the world, next to Tibet, and we traveled up there. And you drive on, it's the highest motorable road on earth, and you have to travel. You drive over three passes that are above 16,000 foot elevation. So that is a very exciting journey, and it was sort of the climax of our trip.
Wow. And you know, there's so much to discover in India. And just briefly tell us about your favorite foods. What did you eat there? What was part of that like?
Well, we ate a lot of Indian food, I'll tell you. The food was like an adjustment. That was the biggest adjustment for our kids, you know, who were used to eating toast and macaroni and cheese and apple slices and really bland American diets. So they had to adapt, yeah, and they did. And so, you know, we ate a lot of rice and dal, which is sort of the mainstay food of India. And, of course, delicious, spicy curries that, you know, were so spicy that the girls would just eat a little bit of that. And boy, and I guess I would say food-wise, South India just really took it for us. We were down in Kerala for a month and a half or so, and the food down there is so delicious. The breakfast is these doughy lentil pancakes called idli or dosas, and you have them with like a sweet mango chutney and coconut sauce, and they're just so delicious. And down in Kerala, coconuts are just everywhere. It's just the food source, the fiber source, the material source. So everything was coconut. Coconut curry, coconut fish, coconut rice, coconut beet salad.
Dina, I have to stop and I have to go to commercial break, but I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. It's Dina Mose, and the name of the book is The Buddha Sat Right Here, A Family Odyssey Through India and Nepal. And I'm going to have Dina back on in the summer because we're going to be talking about writing a memoir. And I think of all the memoirs I've read recently, This stands out because you have made it really a family adventure, and by including your daughter's work in it, I think it makes it just such a touching book, and I'm sure everyone will enjoy it, and it's available wherever books are sold. And what, do you have a website do you want people to go to?
Yes. It's my name, DenaMoes.com, DenaMoes.com, or you can just Google the Buddha sat right here. You'll find me.
Okay, and we're going to find you back here sometime in, I think, the end of June or July, okay?
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really nice.
Okay, it's been a joy talking to you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Let's go to commercial.
This is the TAM Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660. Or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the TAM Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and in a little while I'm going to be talking to Neil Millick. And are you there, Neil?
Yes, I am. Good morning. How's it going?
Well, good morning, Neil. I am so happy. This has turned out to be such an absolutely fantastic day, because this is one of the magical things in life. Since I started this program, all sorts of threads have connected into sort of a magical tapestry, and I never know what's going to happen. So today, from two different, you know, ends of the world, I have a program about India, because my first guest today was Dina Moes, who wrote a book called The Buddha Sat Right Here, and it's a family odyssey through India and Nepal. And then from a separate, absolutely different publicist, I booked you, and I didn't know at the time anything about your book, so I didn't know anything about you. And so it turns out it's an India day, because I am deeply involved with India. As a matter of fact, I spend a good part of my day mentally in India, because I am writing a book that's set in Baroda. So, and I'm planning a trip to India. So it all just worked out so beautifully today.
Well, you can say that again. I, for one, don't believe in coincidences, but I might be swung around now.
Well, you have to be, because this is really strange. That this would happen, because I, as I said, I'm writing a book about India. It's set in the 1800s, but I know Baroda so well. I could draw you a map of Baroda, of every house in Baroda. So it's so funny that, you know, because I'm so involved in India, always thinking about India, that I would have both of you on today. So, wow, And I'm excited
phenomenal.
Because
I couldn't draw a map of the neighborhood I live in, so I am mightily impressed. So when do you visit India next?
Well, I not next. It'll be my first time because I've written the book. It's based in the 1875, so 1880s. I'm doing historical research, but I haven't physically walked there. So I'm planning toward the end of the year to do India. So it's exciting. And when I got your book, I was so impressed. As I said, I didn't know anything about you. And then I started reading this book, and it's called Dark Blossom. The book is beautiful. The cover is one of the best I've ever seen. And I've been holding...
Oh, wow, thank you so much.
I've been holding it up because we're also on YouTube, so I was holding it up for everyone to see. So we'll start there, and then we'll talk a little bit about you. You are an amazing person, and the work that you're doing is amazing. So tell us about the idea for the book. You've written it in the first person as a character. What? Tell us about this character.
Well, it was incredibly challenging, actually, because I narrated the book from the perspective of an American psychologist who's a woman. And actually, all three characters are so different from me. And that's part of why I wrote the book in the first place, because all I really wanted to do was crawl under these different characters' skins and describe the world the way they were seeing it and their interactions. And I just wanted to go on that journey to see if I could. It's been a very, very gratifying journey since.
And you pulled it off, because as I'm reading the book, I have a policy. I never look really at the, other than the front of the cover, I never read anything about a book before I start it. I don't read, anything that's like the publicist sent out or anything about the book or even the back of the cover. I never read anything because I want to approach it with a fresh eye. And so when I'm reading it, I mean, if your goal was to capture the how one would think that an American woman would think, you did it. I mean, I was blown away when I discovered who wrote it, actually. Because at first I thought, this is an American woman writing this book, and you did it. You did a great job.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you so much. So where have you reached, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, no, I've read all the whole... I read everything, but what was so wonderful, the characters, as you say, you have three main characters. Why don't you lay out the story the way you want to tell people, how much you want to tell people about it? Because there's a suspense in here. There's it has a wonderful buildup to in the story. So tell us about it.
Sure. The story is pretty simple. The story is about an expat living in New York City who's pretty well assimilated into the culture. And one day he comes back from a business trip and realizes that he's lost his family to a tragic car accident and tries to cope with it, but unable to find the answers that he's looking for, seeks the help of an American psychologist, Cynthia, who's the narrator of the story, for help. And unbeknown to both these characters, Cynthia's 16-year-old rebellious daughter, Lily, is kind of harboring certain secrets that come to the fore as the story unravels. And it's really a story of the relationship of these three people and their own battles and their own struggles with one another over a two-year period that kind of unravel as the story unfolds. And, There are many, many questions that kind of find their resolution, but in the denouement, there is an open question for the audience as well, and I want to see what people feel about that, because I find that very intriguing as to how one story, one aspect of life can have such different connotations depending on who's seeing it.
Well, as you pick this method of bringing the story to life, by putting it through the eyes of this psychologist. And there are secrets, all three of them have different level of secrets, different level of things that they're at first not talking about and then that are revealed throughout the book, with little hints, I think, also along the way. So there's a freshness to this writing that I was really, I found so delightful to read.
Well, thank you so much. The interesting thing is many people who have now, it's only been about 2.5 months since it's been published, and many people seem to be appreciating it as a psychological thriller. To me, however, it remains a story of love in spite of loss, of empathy in the face of adversity, because I myself fell into writing at a time that I was struggling with empathy, and I realized by being on this journey of putting these characters' lives down on paper that I kind of got a double dose of empathy, if you will. I needed to have empathy for my characters to take them through their entire range of expressions and interactions. But moreover, I also needed to have empathy for the readers to have a certain impact on them. And that filled that personal void in my life. So it's been very gratifying personally, as well as I've discovered a new passion. So I couldn't be happier.
Well, it was really hard when I realized that it's your first book that you have been able to capture that the feeling of first when we started off and we felt, you know, this tragedy, and as you go through the story, as you're writing and bringing in the characters, and I particularly enjoyed reading about Lily. I thought you did her so well. And again, from, you know, a man writing about a young girl's feelings and thoughts, it was really great. You did a fantastic job on it. And what I like, you know, Lily, there's something very touching about Lily. How did you come out with this character?
Well, I think I'm all of them too. While I'm not neither one of them, I'm also all of them. There's at least bits and pieces of me in all of them. I've been through that rebellious phase in my life. And I've lived in three different continents. I work with many, I mentor women entrepreneurs globally. I, at this point in time, spend time pro bono with 4 women-led NGOs. And I've had the opportunity of some great women mentors in my life. But none of them are teenagers, but I feel that my journey through life has taken me to such disparate places and made me meet such rich characters that I have it in me to be able to empathize with these characters. And I've been a teenager myself. I've thrown tantrums and fits. And at the same time, I've been brought up in a way where I think I have a reasonable head on my shoulders, but I'm also an empathic individual. So I think I try to capture all of that in Lily. And her journey through her teen years, although for me the main characters still are Cynthia and Sam, and you know how their relationship evolves over the period of the story.
Now, of course, you're a computer guy. That's your background, right?
Yeah. Yes, I have done my master's in computer science. Correct.
So when did you ever imagine that you were going to be a novelist?
You know, the weird thing is that I did my computer science from one of the best universities in the U.S., Carnegie Mellon, and it was one of the toughest years of my life as well. And just last week, one of my mentors reached out to me on Facebook, and he says something like, you know, you remember the time when you told me that you wanted to write a novel? And I had a back and forth with him, and I couldn't for the life of me remember when I must have said that to him. So I guess somewhere this dream might have been festering, albeit I wasn't aware of it or I had forgotten about it. So I guess it was meant to be.
It was meant to be. When, you know, when you find this sort of joy of writing, when you first start writing and you realize the words that are going on the paper can change people's lives, because people can read this book and discover something about themselves, because you have a lot of, you know, psychological discussion here between Cynthia and I think that as people are reading, they're going to say, yes, I see that, I understand that, and you know, when you first started writing, on the first time when you sat down and said, I'm going to write this book, how did it feel? That, because when somebody hasn't been, you know, a lot of people have been writing since they were, you know, 8 years old, they've been writing, trying to write. But coming to it from a different perspective, coming from it at an older age, now, you know, how did it feel when you first sat down to just start typing this book or writing it? I don't know. Did you start with typing it?
Well, I did. I had little choice but to write it on a computer, given my profession. But I think you've kind of touched on two really, really important themes of the journey of writing the book. One is that, strangely enough, I wasn't aware that I was writing a book, and since the publication, I haven't really been moved per se by the adulation that I seem to be getting. But there have been two or three people that have reached out to me. One, a 15-year-old girl, and another, a mother of three, who reached out to me, telling them what they've taken away from it, and it was interesting. The mother, she said something like, I've realized that it may be more important to be a friend to my daughters than a parent, given their age. And the 15-year-old girl, and I don't think, no matter how this career plays out, I don't know if I could top that. The 15-year-old girl said something like, my life is going to have highs and lows, and I can't aim for perfection, and I should find happiness in the things that work out and not worry about the things that don't. And if somehow they've gotten this message from it, even though it's a suspenseful novel, I find that the entire effort of writing it, editing it 60 times, has all been worth it. Going to how I felt, like I said, I did not know I was writing a book. My first reader was my dad. And I think he enjoyed the process with me. And what I did not realize at that time was that I was going through some kind of a catharsis of sorts. That being said, I had to do this while doing a full-time job. So I think for the 60,000 words that I put out there, I gained 2 pounds for every 10,000 words. So other than my fitness that took a backseat, it was a very deeply cathartic experience for me. That's about it.
When it's funny, when people start writing, people who hadn't, you know, really thought of themselves as novelists, and they write it, when you like wrote your first chapter, did you sit back and say, wow, I did that?
No, but strangely enough, a couple of weeks back, I had this conversation with a person who runs a printing press, he does textbooks more than anything else, but a very knowledgeable man. And he said something like, you know, I've heard that writing the first chapter is easy and the rest of it is really difficult. And my reply to him was that I'd like to consider it at a different level of abstraction, wherein I think you write your first book is easy and writing the second one a whole lot difficult, because when you write the first one, in some ways, you're so obsessed and fascinated with the story and with the entire process that you just can't wait to get to the end of it, and you enjoy that journey. But then you realize what you've gotten yourself into, and you have all these imaginations and the pressure that builds up, and getting to write the first chapter of the second one, that's a different ballgame altogether.
Well, it is powerful. A novel can be very powerful, as you've discovered. People do find answers. People do, or questions. They, when they're reading a book and they relate to the characters, it's because the author has done something very powerful. He has connected a character to the overall humanity of man. Something beyond ourselves. And so when you write this book, although, you know, you're not a female psychologist, you've managed to write a powerful story, and her words and her own confusion and her own problems that come through her as she's writing are so powerful that you really do capture the reader.
Well, thank you so much for that feedback. It really means a lot. I think you've hit on an interesting thread, because as a writer, I grew up in India. I've spent a bit more than a decade in the U.S. I've lived in Europe as well. I don't know if I belong to a certain culture. I think I've tried to imbibe different aspects from different cultures, but I think there is a certain cultural undertone to how I emote. And in my journey of wanting to be a writer that is appreciated by global audiences, I've realized that it's a fine balance as to how you capture those emotions on paper. So the vulnerability that comes across, I believe that that's there in all of us, but the way we express it might be slightly different across cultures. So I found that I had to go back a lot and try to adjust the tempo at which and how I express that vulnerability and that emotion, for Cynthia at least. I think it's going to be a journey that is going to take me a lifetime, but I hope to be able to get better on that.
Well, you certainly started off with a big hit here, because I think, as you said, it's only been out a little while, but it will get noticed more and more, because book sales often depend so much on word of mouth. People will say, I read that book and it really touched my heart. It really meant something to me. And I think that as people are reading this book, they will say, wow, how did he do it? And that's part of the fun of reading this book, because I thought, you know, I got into the story and I wanted to know more and I wanted to know what was happening. And that's the something that a great writer does. And you managed to do it. And I am really so happy that I had you on today, because as I said, it's turned out to be a day for India. Because Dina Mose is, of course, American, and she took her family on a journey to India and wrote about it in The Buddha Sat Right Here. So there's this element of India that has a very special significance in sort of a depth of the history of India brings out this depth in people. So I think you've done a beautiful job here.
Thank you so much. Really do appreciate that. And I think these dots were meant to connect, I guess, in some way. And it would be an awesome privilege for you to look me up when you're here.
Oh,
I have had the unique opportunity to be tour guide to a lot of my friends visiting from the United States. And should you need a friendly face or a tour guide, I'd be happy to throw my hat in the ring.
Oh, okay, well, I will take you up on that. Meanwhile, let's talk a little bit about, is that when you've done something that I never saw any other author do, you offered people that they could win a trip. Is that still open or is it closed?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's on a website, wintrip2ny.com, where 2 is the number 2, not spelled. And essentially, up for grabs are one business class ticket and an economy class ticket to anywhere in the world. And should the winner so desire, they could essentially not take me up on that ticket and donate that money to charity. I'm also donating half my royalties to an NGO based out of India that is devoted to the primary education of girls from the most impoverished sections of our country. And the contest really all... It brings up one question at the end, which is kind of an open-ended question. And I feel I'm a novice at this, but I feel that an author's journey into their own character's lives is seldom complete. And there is a question about the motives of one character that I ask at the end and on the contest. And I'm interested in seeing how people think about other people's motives. And I think you said it right. This book hopefully will show people how they approach lives. It's meant to be an introspective story as well. And I've been curious to see what people have to say to that. And I've been getting all kinds of responses. I'm not going to give away any of them, because that'll be a spoiler, but I'm getting all kinds of responses from, you know, very sentimental ones, from completely outrageous ones, but all of them essentially asking for a sequel. Not sure if there's going to be one, but you never say never, I guess.
Exactly. Well, writers always love to be asked to write more. So, and I'm sure you will be many times over, because this is exciting. It's like the birth of a new writer, and you have done a wonderful job. I want to just spell your name for people. It's N-E-E-L, Neil, Mullick, M-U-L-L-I-C-K. And so you can go to Neil's website. I'm going to put this on my website so that people can find a link. I think you have done a beautiful job with this book, Neil, and I so admire your work with the Foundation, Claire Blair Foundation for Women, and that you're involved in helping girls get an education, and of course encouraging reading, which is what I do. That's what I want to do. I so love to have authors on who want to encourage everybody to read. I had David Baldacci on last week, and of course he has a foundation that provides books to food banks, so that they can hand out, when they hand out food, they hand out books, because books are the food for the mind. And so I so admire the work that you're doing with your organization. And so people can also find out more about the Steering for Greatness Foundation, and some of your other work. And it's all on Neil Mullick's website. The book is Dark Blossom, available where books are sold. Go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble. But it's beautiful. The cover is beautiful. And the book is beautiful. That's the truth. Okay?
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that feedback, Badri. And my offer of you looking me up stands. It's been a complete delight.
Okay. Thanks so much for being on Joy on Paper today, because it was a joy to talk to you. Bye-bye, Neil.
My pleasure entirely. Have a wonderful day, Ed.
Thank you. Bye. Whoop. What a day. What a day. Yes. Okay. This is has been a really exciting for me, because, as I said, I just love both of the books, and you will too. And so it's Neil Mullick, Dark Blossom, and The Buddha Sat Right Here. And you can read all about it. Please go to my webpage, radio-joy on paper. I'm going to have both of these interviews up, and some other information about how to contact both of them, because you might want to do this trip to India too. So anyway, it's fun. And it's radio-joyonpaper.com. Meanwhile, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're really, really lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a film, a streaming video, or even a television series like Carol J. Perry's is going to be, because I keep telling everyone in Hollywood, get Carol J. Perry. She's got a wonderful, wonderful cast of characters ready to go on television. And, of course, say something nice to somebody today, because it's a beautiful day all over. I think everybody, even up north, they all have, spring has sprung, and it's a gorgeous day. And say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. I appreciate you. And have a great time, and I will be back on Thursday with a surprise guest. Bye-bye.